everybody. I'm Ashton Demery.
And I'm Nicole Demery. And welcome back to our Atheist Bible Study, where I am currently struggling to come up with a way to announce that we have some news to share without saying the phrase, "So we did a thing."
I really don't know what you're referencing right now.
It's like a millennial thing. Everybody's like, "So we did a thing." And then it's just like, they had a baby or something.
I'm not as keyed in, I guess, to the...
All right. Millennial culture.
All yeah.
Right, got it. Okay. So we were invited to go on somebody else's podcast recently, and it was super exciting slash like nerve wracking, but really cool overall, like really cool, positive experience.
Yeah. I thought it was really good. I think we were both nervous going in, just based on listening to her previous episodes and knowing what her background was and not knowing whether this was really going to be more of a discussion or a debate or a trial or what it was going to be.
Yeah. So, okay. So the podcast is And Other Things by Mondelez, and she has a Christian background, and.
Which I guess we do too.
Yeah. But it comes like through more in her podcast. I would say that that's still something that she values. Whereas for us, we forsake it. Like, and so, yeah, so I think initially it was just like, oh, cool, we're getting invited to go to a podcast. That's so cool. And then it was like, wait, but she's Christian. Maybe this is a trap.
Like, yeah.
But it wasn't like that at all. She's so nice, like so welcoming. I was telling Ashton, like, I felt like I kind of blacked out during the recording of it because it just felt so comfortable. Like it just felt like a Zoom call with a friend. And so that's kind of what made it scary afterwards, because I was like, what did I say? Did I say like some like outlandish things that like I can't remember anymore?
Yeah, well, I think Mondelez is really good at sort of listening to what someone's saying and then trying to, you know, to summarize or restate it and really understand what that person's saying. So I think she really focuses more on just like getting your side of the story than having any kind of like a debate or inserting her own.
Yeah. Which was something too, that I was thinking back to, was like, I almost wish I had asked her more questions. Like it felt like, you know, we were in the position of being asked the questions and responding, but afterwards I just had so many more questions about her and her life. And so I don't know. Afterwards, I was like, was I being rude? Like, I didn't ask her anything.
Well, I think that's the point of her show.
But yeah, so obviously we wanted to plug her show. So again, it's called And Other Things. So if you want to listen to the episode that we're on, that should be coming out hopefully around the same time this episode is coming out. So I think her episode will be coming out the 19th of this month. But yeah, so like looking back on it, it was one of those things where it's like, as soon as we finished, I was like, that was amazing. That was so good. Like, I had so much fun. And I think we got a lot of like great conversation out of that. And then 2 hours later, just like full panic mode. Just like, was that the worst thing I've ever done? Did I like say something dumb? Did I embarrass myself? Like, and then you can't go back and listen to it because like we don't have the recording.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think I always end our podcast recordings with that kind of same feeling, too. But then I listen to it and I'm like, okay, no, that's not that bad.
Right. And I think you can never really, like, say things perfectly the way you want to say when you haven't prepared in advance for them and it's kind of on the spot. And you're being interviewed by somebody else, not necessarily somebody you know really well.
Yeah.
But what would you say is the thing from that you're kind of most latching on to, like the conversation that you would want to revisit if you could?
Okay. I have thought about this so much since she asked this. So she asked this really great question about, I am forgetting the exact number, but it's a pretty high percentage of the fact that most atheists are white and like most people who leave their religion are white. And she asked us like why we thought that was, and we both, you know, did our best to make some semblance of an answer to that. But yeah, I can't stop thinking about it because I really want to know. Like, I don't know why that is, but it's worrisome to me a little bit because, you know, anytime white people are doing something, it's like, oh, maybe I should take a second look at that. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
It's like one time, okay, someone said this thing to me once, or no. Someone in a TikTok once said, if men are in your comment, white men are in your comments cheering you on, maybe reevaluate like what you're saying. And I think it's scary, especially to me, because I, as someone who used to be a pick me girl, like, you know, who wanted to be one of the guys and all that, it's terrifying for me to like ever go back to that spot where I'm doing right. anything to make men happy.
Yeah, so that's definitely the one that I've thought about the most. And it's something I was kind of aware of before, and I thought about it before, but kind of not really put a lot of thought into it. But it is a really good question. And it's not only that atheists are predominantly white, they're also predominantly male,
mm-hmm.
right? They fit all of these sort of, they tend to be made up of a sort of more privileged population.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer I gave is a reasonable one, which is it kind of comes from the fact that minority groups as a survival technique have often needed to assimilate.
Yeah.
And so if you're a group that's being told you're not American just by nature of who you are,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to do anything else that's going to get you labeled as more un-American, which would be not identifying with the predominant religious group.
Right.
But I'm sure there's more to it than that, and I don't think it's fair to take a question like that and to sort of deflect and just say, well, it's not really a problem with the group itself.
Right.
Because I don't know that, and I think it warrants more discussion and more looking into.
Yes, I 100% agree with that.
So the other thing we wanted to talk about a little bit before we get started is we've gotten some comments and some feedback that people want to hear a little bit more about the New Testament. You know, everybody kind of knows, at least among atheists, that the Old Testament is pretty BS. And then Christians often use, or apologists often use the out when you're discussing the Bible that, well, none of it applies anymore, only the New Testament, you mm-hmm. know. So we have gotten some feedback to do more of that, which we were planning on doing eventually anyways.
Yeah.
So what we want to know is if you would be interested as our audience in hearing us go continuously through the Bible as planned in order of the books, or if you want to see us do a little bit of switching back and forth so that we can get a little bit of New Testament now while also continuing through the Old Testament. So we would essentially alternate books every time
mm-hmm.
So that you can get a little bit of both.
Yep.
So we're going to put a little poll on Twitter. Give you the opportunity to weigh in. So definitely check that out and let us know.
Mm-hmm. And our Twitter is now linked in all of our descriptions. So it should be way easier to find now.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get into it.
Do it.
All right. So
Numbers part two.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we start off with Aaron and Miriam being big mad at Moses. So they're upset partially because I get the sense that they feel like, why is Moses so special when God is apparently speaking through all of us? Like, why is he this chosen one? And also, it says that they're mad because he married a Cushite woman. And the big deal here being that Cushites are from Ethiopia, so they are black. And we get this weird, like, fourth wall break in the narration of the Bible where it says in parentheticals, for he had indeed married a Cushite woman, as if that is something that, like, hey, reader, he really did that.
Yeah.
And also we know this because we know that Cushites are black because in another Bible verse it says, can a Cushite change his skin or a leopard its spots?
Didn't know that.
Yeah, that comes later on in Jeremiah. And then from there, the narrator again makes this statement about Moses is the most humble person on earth.
I really like that line. Especially with the knowledge that most Christians believe that Moses wrote all of this.
Mm-hmm. So, and Moses, it says, the most awesome man.
Yeah. It says, now the man was very humble, more so than anyone else on the face of the earth.
Well, now that I know that, that changes the parenthetical interpretation too. Like, Moses being like, for I had indeed married a Cushite woman.
Yeah.
All right. So then, so God calls all three of them, Aaron, Moses, and Miriam, to his tent to tell them that Moses is indeed his favorite child. And it's because he speaks to him face to face. So God speaks to everybody, I guess, through dreams, kind of. But Moses actually gets to see God in person.
Right.
And then God just gives Miriam leprosy, just for the fucking hell of it. Doesn't give it to Aaron, who also had these same equal complaints, but he gives Miriam leprosy. And when Moses tries to pray to God to say, like, hey, please heal her, God says that if her father had spit in her face, then she would have to bear that shame for 7 days. That's his rebuttal.
Yep.
And then no mention as to why Aaron didn't also get it. And then so, as per the rule, she's kicked out of the camp for 7 days. And then I guess she's cured from it because it says that she's allowed back in after that 7 days.
Yeah.
This story is such a reminder to me that I was always going to leave this faith. This is always, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever read the book, it was. Yeah.
There's nothing here for me.
No. So this is a kind of weird story, especially coming off of a lot of the priestly text that we talked about last week, how we've just sort of transitioned into kind of out of the priestly text into the JE text again. But all of this here, we're going to find still kind of goes back and forth. We'll pick up with some passages that are entirely priestly, and we'll also have priestly redaction in the midst of all of this. But
when we get to those, can I guess which ones are the priestly ones?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
So looking at all the stuff we just read in Leviticus and Numbers, it's really weird to have this story that kind of attacks Aaron, right? Because Aaron's like he's a big deal among the priests, right? So again, we're back in the JE text, and this is really a polemic against Aaron and the Aaronid priest. We remember the Elohist source is from the northern tribes of Israel. So the kingdom of Israel vice the kingdom of Judah. And at the time that the Elohist text was written, it's understood that the Mushites were the ones who, they were kind of the head of the cult, right?
Okay.
The Mushites are those who believe they are descendants of Moses himself.
Okay.
So they, not the Aaronid priests, are the ones leading it. So what you have in this is this sort of rivalry between different groups that believe themselves to be sort of the spokespeople of Yahweh, or the ones who get to interpret his will. And they use these as these kind of parables as a means of settling those disputes, right? They look back to some time in the archaic past and say, look, we've already settled this dispute. It's the Mushites who ultimately interpret the will of Yahweh. We saw when Aaron tried to step in and say that he spoke for Yahweh, we saw that he was wrong and Yahweh told him. Whereas in the priestly text, you'll see there's no mention of Aaron ever doing anything like this. And in fact, Aaron is the only one who is consecrated, not Moses, even though Moses remains a prominent figure in the priestly text. Another place where the Elohist text does something similar is you look back to the golden calf. We actually have a quote from that section. When Moses saw the people were running wild, parentheses, for Aaron had let them run wild. Another attack by the Elohist text on Aaron to show that anyone who attempts to speak for Yahweh but Moses will be rebuked.
Okay.
These are also the only places in the Pentateuch where Aaron refers to Moses as my Lord, showing that he is subordinate to Moses.
Oh. Yeah, so I have this only partially worked out in my head, but I'm going to commit it to the podcast anyways. If God and the devil were both real, I'm pretty sure I would choose the devil. I would worship the devil. Just like looking at how God treats women, why would I want that for myself? As a woman reading this Bible and seeing, you know, the kind of roles that women fulfill in this or are supposed to fulfill in the culture, I hate it. I would be so miserable. But I'm like, why would I choose that for myself? When what I know about the devil is he gives women choices. You know, he hasn't shown up that much in the Bible so far, except in the beginning when he tempts Eve with the apple. Well, I say tempt. He's offering her, you know, the knowledge of good and evil, which is seems better than being a companion to someone, like being made as comfort for somebody else. Like, that's my purpose, is to bring satisfaction to Adam's life, who, you know, apparently wasn't that happy without me.
Yeah. I think that's, so it's interesting to me that at least so far in the Bible, and as far as I'm aware in all of the Bible, there aren't a lot of passages that describe or attribute anything truly immoral or evil to Satan.
Mm-hmm.
All of what makes Satan evil, according to the Bible, really comes down to rebellion and comes down to leading people away from Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
right? So a lot of the Bible's interest, especially in the Old Testament, is interested not so much in true morality of doing good things in the world,
yeah.
but on knowing, again, like that knowing your place, that like hierarchy and people fitting into the places that they are assigned to.
Yeah. The other thing I want to say, too, is, like, reading the Bible is really hard for me because, one, it's so boring, and, two, there isn't a lot of interesting, you know, women in it. And I think this religion clearly wasn't made for women. Like, when I say, like, there's nothing here for me, it's because it wasn't made for me at all, and that's very obvious to me now reading it. And it just kind of reminds me, like, I know a lot of men really hate the Ghostbuster revamp where it's all women. They hate Bridesmaids. They hate Birds of Prey, where Harley Quinn is, you know, kind of remade. And I think it's because they don't see themselves in it. You know, those are movies made for women to be consumed by women. And, I really enjoy all those movies. And I think it's because I see myself in them. And when I'm reading this book, like, I don't see myself in this. Like, I don't see any women who I identify with, who I like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I had to say about that. All right. So next we have God asking Moses to send out some spies into Canaan, the land God has promised all of them. And they are told to go out there to suss out the people, the land, and to steal some fruit. And so they go, they take some pomegranates, grapes, and figs, and they come back, and they report what they saw to everybody. So they say that the land flows with milk and honey. They say the people are strong, the towns are fortified and large. So basically saying, like, it's not going to be easy to come in here and overtake them. Like, they have a good thing going on for themselves. So Caleb, you know, wants to go right away. He's like, let's get all our stuff. Like, I'm so excited to, like, go and get this land. But the spies, having seen everything, they have kind of worked out that they don't really stand a chance to go in there and invade Canaan. So they start to lie and say all these things. Well, we would probably die if we went because the people there are descendants of Nephilim, which, do you want to remind everybody what the Nephilim were?
The Nephilim are the descendants of angels mm-hmm. who had sex with human women.
Mm-hmm. And so they say that they're descendants of Nephilim and that they're huge and that they felt like grasshoppers next to them. So they're basically lying and saying that this is a land of giants.
Yeah. Well, apparently not lying, at least according to the scripture itself, says that they truly are the descendants of Nephilim.
Mm. So we sidestep away from this, you know, report of Canaan, and we start talking again about how the people think that their life was better in Egypt, and they, you know, they start to make
sounds like it was.
They start to make these half. Well, okay, I feel like in my gut I would say, oh, this story isn't true, because what people in their right mind would want to go back to slavery? I don't know. I mean, as someone who has never been a slave. It doesn't come from people who are slaves. I can't imagine anybody ever saying, like, oh, I would love to go back. And I know it's different from how we picture slaves.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, one, it, this gets so confusing. The Egyptians never had Jewish slaves, so there's that. But the way that we sort of imagine what their slavery was like is different from how, you know, we treated enslaved people in American history. But I still think that not having any freedom is something that people would not want to go back to.
Right. And I mean, that just comes from all of these stories are not meant to be historical. They weren't written to be historical. They were written to make certain points and to tell certain stories for political reasons, for theological reasons, and whatever else.
Right. Okay. So they start to make half plans to go back to Egypt. While the people are saying that they would like to go back to Egypt, now the spies start to change their story again, and they start talking about how awesome the land is and how, you know, if they stick to this land, they follow God, then, you know, they're going to get this promised land and life is going to be really good. The people, like, just, you know, aren't really having it, don't really agree with that. And so God gets pissed and threatens to take away their inheritance. So then God is actually about to kill all the people once again for saying that they would rather live in Egypt. And so Moses talks him down from it by preying on God's toxic masculinity. So he says, okay, if you do this, God, then this is what the people are going to say about you. They're going to say that you were too weak to free your people from Egypt and have them survive in the desert. That's going to be your legacy as a God. And so, and he also reminds God, like, hey, you're supposed to be slow to anger. Remember when you said that about yourself? And so then God says, okay, but that the people who despise him will not get to see the land. God starts praising Caleb. He likes that Caleb was, like, you know, eager to go into the land and conquer it. He says that Caleb will be the only one to actually be able to see it, and everybody else won't get to see it. They'll die off, and only their descendants will get to see the land. And so they turn around and start heading back to the Red Sea because God, you know, isn't going to lead them into Canaan right now.
Right. So as you read this story, did you have a difficult time following it at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So most of the Bible stories are very difficult to follow, but this one especially reads very weird.
What parts of it would you say were troubling?
Okay, so when the spies come back, they give this report. It's like a positive, glowing report, right?
Yeah.
And okay, so like just first read through, it sounds like the land is really awesome. But they accidentally like hype up the people too much about it. Whereas like, you know, they're really worried about going in there. So they kind of change their tune a little bit and start describing how terrifying the people are.
Yeah.
And then, so the first time I read it, I thought they were making up the fact that they're huge. But when you read it a second time, it sounds like they really are. They really do believe these are the descendants of Nephilim. They say that they're large, and I don't know how much they're exaggerating how large they are.
Yeah. So the main part I want to key in on here is what you're talking about, where it seems like they tell the story, they say it's great and all this stuff, and then all of a sudden they switch and they're telling a different story, and then like kind of difficult to follow who they're even telling this all to.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some heavy priestly redaction going on in this passage. So you can kind of read it and it be somewhat consistent if you skip the right lines. So in one version, they essentially come to Moses, and only Moses, and they tell him the land really is everything that it was said to be, but there are these huge Anakites and we don't think we can defeat them. And then Caleb kind of settles them all down and says we should do it because this is what, you know, God said we should do.
Right.
But then there's a priestly redaction in which they change it. So you'll notice in 26, and they came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the Israelites in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh, which is another interesting point. In another part, Kadesh is in the wilderness of Zin, not Paran. They changed the geography a little bit. But the immediately following line says, and they told him, when they're supposedly talking to the entire congregation and Aaron and Moses.
Uh-huh.
So in the original version, they are just talking to Moses.
Okay.
And then the priestly version, they talk to everybody. And now they go, and in the first lines of Numbers 14, they give them a false report about the land of Canaan. And they say, it's a terrible land. It's not, we're going to be swallowed up by the land. We can't grow food there. All these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to it being filled with giants and whatnot.
Right.
And in this version, it's now Caleb and Joshua instead of just Caleb.
Okay.
And you'll see actually two versions of God's response to all this. One of which he says it's only Caleb who will be spared.
Mm-hmm.
And one of which he says, and Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those, are the only ones who are going to actually see the promised land.
Yeah, because later, we get to this later, but it says that Joshua is one of the spies who went, and God, spoiler, he kills all the spies who gave a bad report, except for Joshua.
Except for Joshua and Caleb.
Was Caleb a spy too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that's again, right? In one version, it's only Caleb, and in one version, it's Joshua and Caleb. So the priestly text is coming from a different historical context, and one in which the northern kingdom of Israel was overtaken by the Assyrians and really was, like, destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So from their perspective, when they're talking about all this, the land of Israel may really be in, like, shambles.
Mm.
So when they're saying that the land isn't good and flowing with milk and honey, that's because their historical context that they're looking at from this from, that might be a true statement. And so that makes more sense to the readers.
Mm.
In addition to that, the Joshua and Caleb part, they're coming from a perspective of a larger version of Israel and maybe want to tell a more united story. Caleb is a descendant of Judah. So from the Yahwist source interpretation, he's the one they care about, right? Because they're going to go in, they're the southern kingdom of Judah.
Okay.
From the priestly text, they want to tell a united story about a descendant of Judah as well as a descendant of Ephraim from the northern kingdom of Israel.
Which is Caleb.
Wait.
No, Joshua.
Joshua, sorry. Yeah. Another thing to note here, if you look at Numbers 13, 22, and 21, they actually change the area in which they scout. So in Numbers 13:22, they end at Hebron, the capital of Judah. The first they go is Wadi Eshkol, just north of Hebron. So they actually stop just north of the former capital of the kingdom of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
And then a previous line to that says they spy out the wilderness from. They spy out the wilderness of Zin, which is a phrase only used in the priestly text, to Rehob, which is much further north.
Mm.
So they actually expand it to just the kingdom of Judah to now they're scouting the entire kingdom of Israel. Again, because from the priestly text perspective, that was all land occupied by Israelites.
Interesting. So God is no longer going to kill everybody right there. He's just decided that only their children will get to go. So he says this again. He says that everybody who is counted in the census will die in the wilderness and their children will be the ones who will see the land and Caleb. And then later on eventually says, and also Joshua.
Because he's so forgiving.
Yeah.
He maintains the curse on their children as well.
And he's so all-knowing. He, of course, didn't need Moses to come to that conclusion. He was always going to come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
He does, however, kill the spies that gave a bad report about the land. So mm-hmm. he wipes them out. By a plague. Moses tells the people what God said, how none of them are going to get to see the lands now. And they all get really bummed out about this. And they say, no, like, we're just kidding. You know, we're going to go. We're going to go do that. And Moses advises against this. He says, you can't do it now. God's not with you. You'll die if you go. And they say, no, we're going to do it. So some of them apparently go and they're killed. I think that this next part that we're going, or did you have anything to say about that?
Oh, well, they'll take note of, so they confront the Canaanites and the Amalekites and they lose. And it says that after the Amalekites and Canaanites defeated them, they pursue them as far as Hormah. So they're coming up south of the kingdom of Judah and in which they have this battle and then they lose to the Canaanites and the Amalekites. It'll come up later.
Okay. Okay. So my guess is that this next part is a priestly text.
You would be correct.
Okay. So this next part, it talks about offerings. So they're given instructions that they're to make an offering when they do reach the land. And when they live there, every time they make bread, they have to give some of that bread to God. And if they forget to do this, then they have to make it a bigger offering.
Yeah. It's basically a summary of Leviticus 1 through 7. We talk about all different types of offerings and the sin offerings and stuff. Here, the unintentional guilt offering has changed from just a bull to a bull and a goat compared to Leviticus 4. And then, like we said, both the passages are priestly, and it sort of emphasizes the main points of the previous one, which is that only an unintentional sin can actually be atoned for. If you do an intentional sin, you're cut off, period. But they've also expanded the things that you would have to do a guilt offering for to include things that are not just prohibitive. So before it was, if you violate anything that you're not allowed to do, now it's if you fail to do anything you're supposed to do as well. And now the tithes go to all the Levites instead of just the priests. And the Levites give another tenth to the priest.
Right. Okay. And then I think this next part is a priestly text too.
You would be correct.
Yay. All right. So in this next part, a man gathers sticks on the Sabbath day. And so the people take him into custody. They're not sure what to do with him. And God says, kill that motherfucker. So they stone him to death.
Yep. Like I said, can't even gather sticks on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm. After killing a man, God then declares that fringe is back in style.
Yeah, it feels like cheating if you're trying to start a fashion trend and you've got an entire cult following that you can just order around.
Yeah, he basically says that like all the priests are to wear fringe on their robes or whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, now I think we're moving out of priestly text. We're getting more of like a story again.
Not quite.
Ooh, okay. All right, so
it's a trick because this one's actually both.
Oh, okay. So next, Korah gathers 250 men and confronts Moses. All these people are upset for the same reason Miriam and Aaron were upset, because, you know, if God is with all of them, what makes Moses so special? So Moses says that in the morning, God will make it known to everybody who his people really are. And he tells the Levites that they should be grateful because God lets them be around holy things, and that they're ungrateful for seeking to be priests as well. From there, Moses calls for some people, but they refuse to come. And so I think, okay, so initially it sounds like Korah and these 250 people confront Moses altogether. But like now it seems like it's just Korah, and he's like, and also all these people support me too.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Cause yeah. Moses calls for them, and then they're like, no, never mind. Like, we're going to stay back here. And then God opens up the earth and swallows all of the people, including Korah.
Kind of. It's really weird because, like you said, it sounds like they're all there, and then all of a sudden the other ones are back at their camp somehow, and you're like, yeah. I thought they were all there. Why is it just Korah now? And it's feels a little lost in translation.
Yes. And so then the next day, the rest of the people who are still alive are mad that God just killed all of these people. And so God kills more people in response, this time with a plague. And Aaron does his best to stop him, but he can't, and God kills 14,700 people with that plague.
Yeah. Is that a record? I feel like that's more than he's killed before. Well, this one is two completely independent stories spliced together.
Okay.
So one of them is a Yahwist story, while the other one is a priestly.
Okay.
So in the Yahwist version of this, it involves Dathan, Abiram, and On, who are all of the tribe of Reuben. And they're all rebelling against Moses.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because Moses is apparently lording over them, and he's failed to take them into the promised land so far. So they're like, why is Moses still in charge here after all this stuff?
Yeah.
And so then they're the ones who get, you know, the earth splits open and they fall down into Sheol, which is like the underworld. And that's that story.
Okay.
a completely independent story is told by the priestly text. And in that one, you have Korah, who is a Kohathite,
mm-hmm.
a Levite, who is rebelling against Aaron, apparently because they want the priesthood.
Right.
So it's a story that the priestly text is telling about the superiority of the Aaronic priesthood.
Mm.
That the other Levites are not priests, and they cannot be priests.
Yeah.
So in that version, it's Korah leading 250 Kohathites against Aaron and the priesthood. And the Reuben story, some scholars believe it might actually reflect an actual conflict that took place at some point in the future from when this story is written, at the time that the Yahweh's text is being written,
mm-hmm.
that the Reubenites would have tried to rebel against the rest of the kingdom of Judah. A thing that I think is interesting about this is, as Americans, we hear a lot from conservatives about the idea that our country is built on biblical principles, mm-hmm. on Judeo-Christian values, they like to say.
Yeah.
One of the things they like to cite is the Declaration of Independence. Right? And they'll point out somewhat like metaphorical and symbolic uses of God in that document as a statement that this is a Christian nation.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is interesting about that is if you really read, especially the Old Testament, it's really clear that biblical principles are completely diametrically opposed to democracy. And to a Declaration of Independence,
yeah,
right? Because this part of the Bible is all about knowing your place.
Yeah.
It's all about that. And at the time the Bible is written, it's the time of kings. It's the time of having individual soul, you know, interpreters of God and single individuals who are solely in charge. And you're being taught in this book to respect that authority.
Mm-hmm.
The Declaration of Independence does not respect authority. That's the whole point.
Right.
Is it's a statement that we do not value your divine right to leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is interesting.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. Now we have the budding of Aaron's rod. So, okay, so this is obviously a priestly one because it's, again, declaring Aaron's, like, divine power over everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess all of the texts are pretty intrigued with Aaron and Moses' rod.
Right. Yeah. There's all these grumblings about the priesthood and who gets to be a priest because, you know, it's not like how it is now where anybody can choose it. You're born into it and it comes later we find out it comes with a lot of privileges. So we see why people would want to be in the position of being a priest.
Mm-hmm.
So every leader of all the tribes gets a staff with their name on it. And Moses places all of these staffs in the meeting tent. And nobody else's stick does anything, but Aaron's starts to sprout buds that grow almonds, and this shows to everybody that God has chosen him. And so they leave it there as a warning to, you know, show this is why Aaron is special, because God has chosen him. And there's this line in there where it talks about how, like, the people now are starting to think, like, we are all going to die. Because if you do anything against God, you know, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Or
you're going to die of hunger, right? Like, if you speak out about dying of hunger, you get killed. But if you don't say anything, you might die of
then
hunger.
Then you also might die, yeah. And so the Israelites say to Moses, you know, we are perishing, we are lost. And everyone who approaches the tabernacle of the Lord will die. Are we all to perish?
What I love about this story is, like, how piss poor as a leader do you have to be to have this, to wield this kind of supernatural power, and people still fucking hate you.
Yeah.
And don't want to do what you tell them.
Like, they just saw it. Like, okay, we get it. Like, God fucking chose you. We still hate this.
Yeah. Like, I just think in most contexts, if somebody's, like, got that kind of power, everybody's like, well, he's in charge. I'm not questioning it. He's in charge. But at this point, they've seen it all, and they still don't care.
Yeah.
And then also the way, like, they've already done all these fucking miracles or whatever, right? And they still hate Aaron and Moses, but God's like, This one. This one's the one.
Yeah.
This one.
Wait till they see
your rod.
Yeah.
Then they'll listen.
Right. So then we get this passage that, you know, repeats the responsibilities of what the priests are doing and what the Levites are doing. And it's very separate. You know, the priests are the important ones. They get to touch the holy things. They perform all the ceremonies. And the Levites are just there to help out. And it says that the Levites are a gift to the priests, which to me sounds like slavery and, again, a sex cult.
Yeah. And it's basically a repeat of Numbers 3 through 4.
Yes. All right. So now we get into some interesting stuff. So I feel like every time we talk about what the priests are allowed to get from the offerings, it increases every time. So this, again, like what we're about to see, expands more upon like what the priests are actually getting.
Mm-hmm.
So it says, now the priests are allowed to eat all of the offerings. So anytime someone is sinning in any way and they bring an ox and they or a bull and they sacrifice it, the priest gets to eat that. And so it's all, so it says, all the best of the oil and all the best of the wine and of the grain, the choice produce that they give to the Lord, I have given to you. And so they can give some to the Levites, but the Levites, what they are given, they have to give a small portion of that back to the Lord.
Right. The best tenth of that.
Right.
To the priest, that is.
Yes. All right. So then there's a ceremony of the red heifer. So in this ceremony, a red heifer is taken outside of the camp and slaughtered in the presence of Eleazar and then burned. Cedarwood, hyssop, and crimson materials are thrown into the fire as well. After Eleazar bathes and comes back to the camp, he is unclean until the evening. The reason why they are, you know, burning this red cow and all these materials is they're going to use these ashes, which are kept outside of the camp, and they're used for purification. So the ashes are added to water to clean anyone who is unclean.
That'll do it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Drink some
cow ash water.
Cow. This is another one of those stories. I really feel like I've read it before, but I could not find that. But also, they kind of go from here into another like full discussion of ritual cleanliness,
mm-hmm.
which is basically like copy and pasted from Leviticus.
Yes. Once again, the people are just asking for a drink of water, and God gets pissed at them for it. So now they're in the wilderness of Zin. Miriam has died, and they're thirsty. So God appears to Moses and Aaron and tells them to take the staff and hit a rock and water will flow out of it. So they do this and everyone drinks from it. But God says, because you did not trust me, I will not lead these people into the Holy Land. So again, we're getting more reasonings for why God doesn't want these people to see the Holy Land. And it's because they asked for some water.
So which source do you think this one is?
It doesn't seem priestly to me. That's the one I feel priestly. Most familiar with. Okay, tell me why.
Well, dead giveaway that it says the wilderness of Zin,
mm.
As well as the phrase Yahweh's glory. Those are priestly phrases that you only see in the priestly text. It's basically a carbon copy of Exodus 17, the same water from the rock story.
Yeah.
However, there are some minor differences here. So, one, it's in the wilderness of Zin instead of Sin, which is the... Again, priestly version. And that one happened before Mount Sinai, while this one is after. And that's a common theme that when there are like two stories, what the redactors tended to do was they would put one before Mount Sinai and one after Mount Sinai.
Hmm.
That was their way of dealing with it if they had multiple accounts of the same thing. This one also gives the reason for why Moses doesn't actually get to go to the Promised Land. There's two reasons that are given. This is one of them. The other one shows up later in the Deuteronomy text. But it's the only place where we talk about it specifically, and it's that he's told to speak to the rock, whereas in the previous story, he was just told to strike the rock.
Mm-hmm.
Told to speak to the rock, and then instead of speaking to the rock, he strikes the rock.
Mm-hmm.
And then water flows. And so it's... The story is that, well, he didn't trust God, and he struck the rock and didn't follow exactly what God said. So now Moses doesn't get to go to the Promised Land either. And I think this one's awesome because it's like the Israelites hear this story and they're like, clearly he didn't trust in God to use his magic by speaking to the rock. He used science and he struck the rock. You know what I mean? Like, Moses is sitting up there like, speak to the rock. That's never going to work.
I hit it last time.
I'll strike the rock. That's science.
Jesus Christ. Next, Moses sends messengers to the king of Edom asking for safe passage through the territory. He says, like, hey, you all know our story of how we used to toil in Egypt and we escaped that. And now we've been wandering the desert and stuff. We would really appreciate it if you would just let us go pass through your lands. We're not looking to attack anybody. We just want to get through it. Edom says no. And then they write back, please, if we take anything, you know, we'll pay for it. And again, they say no. They bring an army against them. And this part's interesting to me. So Edom brings an army against them. And Israel sees this and is like, nope. And they turn around. They don't go and face this army.
Yeah.
Which it feels, and it's weird to me because it feels like if you have a God on your side, you should be able to go against any army and win. Especially if that God has made that promise to you before, that they will tear, as you know, as long as you follow me, I'll tear down any of your enemies.
Right. Well, also, I suppose God isn't necessarily with them right now because
he's mad at them still.
Yeah, he's still mad at them.
Mm. They turn around from this army. Now they end up at this place called Mount Hor. God has decided that Aaron is also not going to be allowed into the Holy Land and that he needs to die right now. So Aaron and his son, Eleazar, who we saw in the story of the red heifer, go up to the mountain together. Aaron strips all of his clothes off, gives his clothes to his son, and then he dies on command.
Yeah.
And one of the most annoying things about the Bible is it will describe something like God will say, this is what needs to happen, and this is how it needs to happen. And then the following passage will literally be, and so then this happened, and they walk through everything again, exactly how God said it needed to happen.
Right.
Instead of just saying, and then that happened. Next, the Canaanite king has now become aware that Israel is on their way. So he sends out a force to go and fight them, and they take some captives. So the Israelites pray to God to let them destroy Canaan, and God says yes. And so they do that.
Yeah, I like how the incentive here is like, if you will indeed give this people into our hands, then we will utterly destroy their towns. Like, the incentive to God is just destruction and bloodshed. They're not promising, like, worship forever. They're like, if you'll let us win, you'll get to see the most destruction you've ever seen.
He will do it so horrifically. Right. Okay, so now they're moving from Mount Hor to the Red Sea because they're trying to avoid Edom since they weren't granted safe passage through. The people begin to complain again. This time, God sends snakes after them. So he's getting a little creative now. A bunch of people are getting bitten by these poisonous snakes and dying. So God tells Moses to make a bronze serpent and put it on a pole. And everyone who gets bit just has to look at it and they will live. Okay, so in Canaanite culture, there were snake cults. And so there were minor gods, like they have found bronze serpents in, where Canaanite used to be. And so it's believed that it was like a minor god that cured snake bites. So I think my theory is that this is, again, like some appropriation here.
Right.
Of, yeah.
They picked up their tradition.
Because, I mean, if you think about it, the last time a animal was crafted out of bronze, a lot of people fucking died.
True. Yep.
So, it's interesting to me because this feels like idol worship. And to spoil, some future things, they do actually go back and kind of, like, rebuke this because they say, like, the people started to take it too seriously and started to see, the snake a little too, something on par with God.
Yeah.
And so they take it away. And then there's also some comparisons that Jesus makes to himself about like being raised up on the cross to save people. Like this snake is raised up on a pole.
Right. So another thing here is the first three lines of Numbers 21 talks about them fighting the Canaanites and winning. And it says, the Lord listened to the voice of Israel and handed over the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their towns. So the place was called Horma.
Mm-hmm.
we talked about this back in Numbers 14. We said to take note, they lose to the Canaanites and get chased to Hormah.
Mm-hmm.
So we have on one hand, place that's called Hormah already existing, and that's the place in which the Israelites are defeated by the Canaanites and Amalekites. And then later, after that, it's called Hormah because they won.
Right.
So this story is like completely out of place.
Yeah.
And you'll see why here, because after this, they're suddenly on this journey.
Yeah.
That goes to all these different places. And that journey is them going around the kingdom of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Transjordan is where they're going.
Mm.
So if you look at this map that I printed out for us.
Okay, which you're going to tweet. So
yeah, I'll have to tweet it so everybody can see. But they're pretty easy to find online. So they initially try to go from the south straight into the kingdom of Judah. They lose. Then later, we just left when they tried to enter through Edom, which again, kingdom of Edom, south of the kingdom of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
They are refused passage to the kingdom of Edom, but then suddenly we're being told they defeat the Canaanites in the hills of Negev. So at this point, they can just go straight north into the kingdom of Judah, and they're in the promised land.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, from Mount Hor, they set out by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. So the rest of this narrative is them going all the way around into Moab.
Right.
Which is on the other side of the Dead Sea from where they're trying to go. So it's just an out-of-place narrative. It really shouldn't have fit it right here because the geography doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make sense in the timeline of the story. And it just sort of got placed in the wrong spot.
Mm. Right. So, okay. So as you mentioned, they start taking this little journey to Moab. And it's weird because when we're first told this story, they are going to be freed from Egypt, and then God is going to take them directly to this Holy Land. That's what they've been promised, you know. That's their whole reason, like, why they're, you know, willing to follow Moses.
Yeah.
Because that's what they've been told. And now they've pissed God off so much, he's not going to take them. So now it's just this kind of, like, weird story where they're doing a lot of, like, backtracking, and, like, they aren't allowed to go there. Like, they aren't allowed to be in the Holy Land right now. So it's just kind of, like, their adventures until this generation dies off or something, until they can be in the Holy Land.
Right. And it almost seems like they're still trying, even though they know mm-hmm. God's told them no, because they're essentially like, oh, well, we can't get in through Edom, so we're going to take the route all the way to the east and then try to come in to the promised land from the east side.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we according to the narrative, it's just not going to happen.
Right. All right. So they send another letter to another king. This time it's King Sihon. I'm asking for a safe passage. Once again, they are denied this. And so King Sihon tries to attack them, but Israel actually wins this time and takes their land. And then they just kind of go on this rampage through a lot of other lands, overtaking them. They take King Og's land too.
Right. This feels like it should be overlaid with like the part in Hercules where he just starts winning a bunch of battles,
yeah,
and just got the music playing.
Yeah.
It's like a montage. I feel like that's where we're at right now.
Right. Because it's not like these are fully fleshed out stories. It just starts listing like all of these places that they start conquering.
Yeah. And I can only assume King Og is like a dwarf king in this whole thing.
Yeah. All right. So that's as far as we were going to get this time, right?
Yeah. That's so we're at Numbers 22 now.
Mm-hmm.
We're about to go into the story of the talking donkey.
Yeah.
It's going to get real interesting real quick.
Once again, I am reminded how little of the Bible I was actually taught.
I do remember something about a talking donkey from before, but I didn't know the details of the story.
I have no recollection of this. No. So I'm excited.
So we're going to leave you off with that teaser there. But as we said, definitely take a look at our Twitter. We'd love to hear what you think about our proposed new plan for our structure.
Mm-hmm.
We'd also love to hear any other feedback you have. I think I'm going to also start trying to post some additional supplementary material on the Twitter too, like that map we talked about, and then a couple of the passages redacted in such a way that you can see the two separate narratives.
Yeah. Bye for now.
Yeah. See you next time.